During this last sit, towards the end, I opened the eyes just to see what time it was. But I also saw us sitting there, very quiet, very quiet. And so much dedication. It's amazing. It's very beautiful. So much dedication. You know, if we're new to this, or have done this for decades, still, there's this dedication, this really giving a lot of energy into this, a whole week of that. It's amazing. My faith is pretty strong. You know, I think we would call it verified faith. You know, not blind faith, but verified faith. My sense is that this is very powerful work that we're doing. Sometimes it's not too clear, you know, I'm just sitting there and waiting for the bell to ring, but there's a lot of things being seen and felt, you know, like a lot of things passing by, and a close encounter, want it or not, you know, just by the fact that it's silence and there's not much happening, there's a kind of a zoom in into our reality, I think. There's a simplicity that I like a lot about these retreats, extremely simple. And there's, you know, in the Buddhist teaching, there's many little lists, some longer, some. The Buddha seemed to have been a list maker like many of us. But he had good lists, this word in English is hard for me. Pedagogy. Yeah, there's a kind of a wave I never get. Pedagogy. So this list, some of them, you can really remember, oh yeah, there's seven of this or three of that. There's one list that is my kind of list, is very short, it's two. I can remember that, or at least the first one, half of it. But I heard this just a couple of years ago. One of the teachers was offering this, and he was saying that for wise understanding or for wisdom to arise, there are two causes possible for wisdom to arise, or wise understanding, or deeper understanding. Do you feel already a little suspense? Like, oh, I want to know that list, you know? If you give me one, I'll take that one. That's the feeling I had, you know? Two causes for the arising of, wise understanding. I really want to know, I wonder what they are, these two causes. And it was very touching for me to hear what came out after, because I immediately recognized it made sense to me. And also, at that point, 2 years ago, I had already spent a lot of time in retreat settings like this, you know, and it seemed almost like an exact description of retreat. And so the two causes that were named there was wise attention, surprise, surprise, wise attention, and the voice of someone else, the wise voice of someone else, can be the cause for wisdom to arise in moi, you know, inside of me. And when I heard that, it really touched me. Even when I'm saying it now, and I've been talking about this now for a number of months, but it's still, I love the simplicity of this. Is attention well put or well spent or something like this? I've seen this so much in my life and in other, that when we put attention in the right way, right kind of attention, things are revealed, things are released, as Heather was talking about today. Things settle, things open when the attention is well given like this. I mean, this is what we do here all day long. Try to find a wise way, the right way to be attentive. And the other one, the wise voice of another, to me, was definitely describing my experience of retreat, was my teacher offering the Dharma, and me sitting there, like, wow, that makes sense. That bit, I'm not sure I want to check this out, you know? But through the voice of somebody else, I was able to be guided, maybe, or open areas of exploration, investigation that would maybe not have come to my mind if it wasn't from that. It's interesting to notice that the Buddha apparently didn't have the wise voice of another. He didn't have access to that. He had only one access to the wise attention. Yeah, so I really love that little list. It confirms why I come on retreat, because I want to hear suggestions of things to investigate, and then I want to do the work of paying attention. And this week, for me, there's been a lot of that. If I just think of the voice of another, I said it to you, Heather, this is an exquisite teacher. Heather is she has a way to word. I travel a lot. I team up with people all the time. This is an outstanding voice. I'm saying this just because that's really how I feel about it. I've heard the Dharma put in words, presented in ways that it opens my mind. It seems like such an exact description, such a vocabulary that not just the vocabulary, you are in there, you know it from the inside. And so it's just one person's take. I want to say that in, you know, in this part of the world, there is a really great voice. And so next week I'll be sitting for a few days. I'll have the chance to sit for a few days in silence, and I think this summer for a few weeks. And this week seemed to me like I was starting to set the tone for the retreats to come. It makes emotion arise because it seems like I'm about to do something that is important, and feels like I've heard things that are sending me well on my way, you know, like I have good little things to consider, which started a lot with the voice of another, you know. So then this other part of the wise attention, there's a little thing here that I want to read you from the text, and it says, there is the case where an untaught ordinary person, that's kind of might be you and me a lot of the time, so an untaught ordinary person, is unskilled and undisciplined in their dharma. They do not understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, they attend to those things unfit for attention and those not and do not attend to those things fit for attention. Do you recognize something in there? When I read this, I was like, yeah, it seems like it's my path to clarify, you know? And so I can sit here and just rumble about stuff, you know? Give attention to incessant planning, rehashing, revisiting, trying to get, strategizing, thinking about moi in this way and moi in that way, you know, and how I could be perceived and how I could have been, and you know, like all this, and I can give hours of attention to these things that, as I'm practicing, as I'm hearing about the Dharma, I'm clarifying what is fit for attention or how maybe is it fit for attention or not, you know. And I can make more clear all the fascinations that I have and say, like, actually, I'm not going to put my attention there. I'm going to put my attention somewhere else. And if you're wondering, like, oh, where, what is fit for attention? Well, that's what we've been trying to explore the whole week and maybe for years of your practice, you know, what is actually fit for my attention. And I remember I say that just as a joke, but still it was kind of surprising. The first time I sat, I learned about this technique of meditation and sat the retreat. It was in Thailand, and so the first evening, Friday night, let's say the retreat starts, they say, it seemed as if they said, so what is going to be fit for your attention tonight and for the next 4 days is your nose. And then I was like, oh my, if you're interested in awakening, enlightenment, liberation, pay attention to your nose. I was like, oh, I'm happy there's the voice of another, because I would not have found that by myself. I would not have thought to look to, you know, to put attention on my nose. That's not where I would have looked for wisdom. Yet, surprising enough, put attention there, gather the attention there, and, you know, settle the mind. This was the technique at that point that was anapanasati, the attention on the breath, and specifically at the nostril. But, you know, and then pay attention, you know, I feel like since I arrived there, I've been like suggesting is the smoothest version, but I've been like banging this idea of like, come back to the body, feel the handle of the door, you know, feel the, as, you know, and sometimes we're like, no, that's not fit for my attention. What it seems fit for my attention is that the fact that this person at work, they don't really, you know, it's like, can you come back here and feel the sitting bones, feel the feet, you know, and it doesn't appear at first like fit for attention. Somebody said, I think John was saying, you know, like my thoughts are so much more interesting than the breath, you know. I think that's what you said one day, you know. It seemed much more fitted for my attention than the body, for example. And then we discovered that the Buddha said, well, in the things fit for attention, the body, the breath, the sensations, the senses, the posture. You know, Munindra Ji saying to Joseph, I've heard that story so many times, just sit there, be aware that you're sitting, and the whole of the Dharma will be revealed. The whole of wisdom will be revealed. And so we learn to pay attention in this way, to put attention in a fit way instead of in a non-fit way, if we could say it like this. And what happens is that, I mean, that's really clearly defined, the fit for attention and unfit for attention. Here it says, things unfit for our attention are ways that we use our attention, because there's always some attention. We're attentive to something, you know. It might not be mindfulness, a full attention, a conscious attention, but we're attending to something all the time, you know. And so things unfit for my attention will make unarisen craving arise, will increase the craving that is there. I wish I was somewhere else. I really wish I was somewhere else. Yeah, if I was somewhere, I could be in somewhere even better than that, you know? Like, or if I was just a little bit more calm, I would like to be somebody else altogether, you know? Like the increasing unfit attention will increase the craving for something. Will it says here, unarisen becoming will arise or increase. I want to be like this. I want, you know. And the reverse, when we put our attention in the right way towards what is fit for attention, or in a way that is fitted. I don't know if I'm using the words right here, but it says, unarisen difficult emotion will not arise, you know. Difficult tendencies of the mind will not arise. And those that have arisen will be abandoned. This is the work we're doing here. The gladdening, the mind that Heather talks about, is putting attention in a way that the beautiful mind states can arise, appreciating nature, for example. You know, the settling that she's been talking about is this also. So letting go of complexity, bringing simplicity, settling. This is describing a beautiful state of mind. Yeah? And so another way to talk about this would be to say unfit attention is the right kind of niche, terroir, some nice kind of environment, thanks, for the five hindrances to arise. You know, the wanting more, the resisting, the you know, the disconnection, the not wanting to feel, the doubt, all this, you know. And on the other way, the attention that we're developing here, the sammasati, the wise attention that we're developing here, tends to bring the seven factors of awakening. That's another list that could talk about what we're doing. We're calming the mental formation. You know, we're bringing more clarity, curiosity in the field. We're strengthening the attention itself, you know, the enthusiasm for practice, the really wanting to be there for reality, for truth, even the bad news, you know. Oh, I'm happy I just saw that pattern with the serving spoon, you know. I'm happy that I saw that, you know. Some kind of courage, confidence comes. All these qualities starts to arise. This might be over the week or over the course of practice. And of course, we know it's not exactly like that. Huh? It's more like like this. But still, there's this that is happening. When I talk about verified faith, it's because I saw the cynicism in this being that was so active, the sarcasm that was the strength of this being, you know, and how it got reduced because it was not wholesome or fit for attention, you know, and how other qualities, it's not personal, it's just a lawful process that is happening. As one of the Burmese teacher I was working with would say, regularly, he would say, Pascal, it's a little bit like if you're trying to walk, let's say, to Seattle from here. The fact that you walk with dread or heaviness or sore feet, or the fact that you walk with canes or that you walk with joy, is a little bit irrelevant. It's the number of steps will get you to Seattle, you know? And so it's the wise attention that you're wisely attending to despair or wisely attending to joy or to calm in a way that you're wisely attending to breath or to mind states. In a way, it's this wise attention will start to reveal things. There are probably a few nuances to put in there. But this teacher kept saying this, and it was reassuring for me. And then I could see at some point, oh yeah, I'm starting to see, you know, Seattle 55, not Seattle 280, you know. So it feels like this, you know, it feels like. Here's an example of something I've read, and this quote for me is really very associated to here, and you might know the story I will tell, but anyway, I read this quote, and to me this extremely powerful quote. It uses a lot of the notion of power and powerlessness here. So it says, that's talking about ways that we use our attention that is unfit, that is entangling. Yeah? Whatever person is greedy for fields, that's an old text, fields, property, or gold, cows, or horses, relations, various objects of desire, the powerless overpowers them. Trouble presses them down, thus unease comes to them like water in a broken boat. To me, this little bit here, the powerless overpowers them. It's so It so exactly describes what happens to me sometimes. And I say, I relate this to here. There's a little friend who wants to hear the Dharma. Little dog there. So I go around and I tell this story a lot, and I think I've told it here, but maybe I have to, in a kind of homage to Samish Island. So the first time I came here 8 years ago, it was about this time of year, I think, or more or less, and it had been kind of coldish with light rain. Does that sound familiar for the area? For a while, but no big storms, no dryness, no. Anyway, when I came, the rhododendron were like totally in bloom. And when I arrived, people were saying like, oh, the rhododendrons, they haven't been like this for 40 years or something. There was something special. Anyway, it created some myth in my mind, you know. And also back east and north where I live, the rhododendrons, they don't do so well. And so I was here, and I remember being sitting here on this hall, on this platform, and the powerless had overpowered me, because my attention was unfit in a way. It was because I would be sitting here sometimes and thinking, oh, when the bell rings or when I ring the bell, I want to go explore the rhododendrons on the island. You know? Should I go this way or that way, you know? And then slowly every day there was something else that was powerless, like a rhododendron. Would you put it in the category of powerless? Well, it was overpowering me, you know, like it was taking a lot of my time. But suddenly there was also the herons, and then the rabbits, and then the swallows, and then the... So I was sitting here, and I was like overpowered by, you know, all these things, until at some point I was like, wow, Pascal, what is happening here? Where is the wisdom here? Can you let the rhododendrons be, you know? And then I regained some kind of like power over my own mind and heart, you know? And so here we learn to clarify this, and I'm joking here, but what are the things that you give so much power to in your life that are really, from somebody else's point of view, powerless maybe, you know? Or... And so when, I'm going to kind of switch a little bit to describe something that happens with the wise attention, a movement of the mind that I find particularly beautiful, that I'm particularly interested in, and that I find, for lack of a better word, particularly powerful. I would say even nuclear, maybe. Something of that nature. And Heather was talking about this last night, but I thought, oh, we could give this even more airtime again tonight, because it's an amazing thing that is happening, and to me is central to this practice. So as we reassure the mind, the system, and it calms down, we get out of our ideas about things, and we start to notice and feel and be in closer contact with reality as it is. Would you agree with that? So we feel the foot stepping, touching the earth. We feel the smoothness or hardness or the mixture of both as we move, or as we put our hand on the table over there, we feel the cold of the touch. You know, there's something real. It's not my ideas about things, but... So the specificity of the world starts to appear, you know. Some things are cold, others are damp and warm. Some things are subtle, others are more gross. Some things are pleasant. And some things are unpleasant. Clearly unpleasant. And some things are neither pleasant nor unpleasant. With the quality of attention, suddenly they become alive and almost pleasant. You know, so there's specificities to it. Some things are heard, thought, you know. And we clarify this. You know, we start to make the difference between a person that we see and the same person that we think of. We start to say, oh, these are two different events. Before, I wouldn't think that. You know, I would be a little fooled, maybe. I see this person doing this, and I go away, I'm in my cabin thinking about this person doing this, and I would think it's the same person. Do you see what I mean? And then I start to say, like, oh, actually, this is a visual thing that is happening. I'm seeing something. And now this is a thought, you know? And it might not be exactly the same thing. Maybe here I'm beautifying, or I'm making worse, you know? And I have to be careful, because I might be taking some information, something I've seen of somebody, and then creating, you could call it in Pali, a nimitta, a sign of something, a concept of something, somebody. And then we're having a fight with this person, or we're getting amazingly along with that person. You know? But it's a made-up thing, and we clarify this. Oh, this. So one teacher used to say, the thoughts of your mother are not your mother. You know, that's kind of a clarification we make. Oh, okay, this is a mind creation, you know. Anyway, things start to get very specific. They even have like, I don't know if it's the right word of the term, the right use of the term, but the way anyway it feels to me, it's suchness. It's so exactly like this right now. So exactly like this, that sensation in the leg. You know? It's not my idea about pain. It's just exactly that right now. It's very specific. Mind states also, joy, this joy now is this specific formation inside me. It feels like this. It's not like any other joy, or it's really different from the despair I felt, or this dejection I felt yesterday afternoon. You know, very specific. Things become outstanding in a way. Have you experienced this? You know, tasting the soup. Oh, this soup is exactly the soup right now, you know. This moment is, yeah. So we go from kind of ideas about the world and then a real encounter with the specificity of events. And then we start to move naturally, I think, towards the universal characteristics of things. So it's not so much that this thing is particularly purple and this thing is particularly red or loud or, what is the opposite of loud? Soft, quiet. You know, it's not so much this, it's the fact that it actually passes. That with sustained calm attention, this is what starts to reveal itself slowly. That it actually is passing, even while it's staying in my feet. The tingling is this particular kind of tingling in my feet right now. But the more attentive I am, what becomes even more outstanding is that there's a river of tingling. It's not one tingling like that. It's a passing of something. Yeah? And this. So that's one of the three characteristics that starts to appear. And this is being noted and discovered. Insight into this is particularly, how am I going to say this? The place, the angle that is particularly interesting is that it's from the angle of the experience, or from the experience itself. What I mean by that is the cherry blossom tree, the cherry tree over there. I start to notice that it's actually changing all the time, because it's there, but as I walk, sometimes I see it, it's beautiful, it's outstanding, but because of my mind state, and Heather was saying this exactly yesterday also, because of my mind state, it's actually the kind of the same. We could say, okay, the flowers will, but right now they're pretty kind of stable for a few days, no? There might be subtleties, but they've bloomed, they're in full bloom. But the experience of the cherry tree is changing depending on my mind state. Sometimes I'm hungry and I couldn't care less about the blossoms, you know? Or sometimes my mind has a certain bent and I walk by and I think it's a beautiful tree, but I'm at the wrong place because the building behind is ugly. And so I don't have the experience of the beautiful tree. It's unstable. It's not like cherry blossom tree, beautiful all the time. It's the experience is changing all the time, depending partly on my mood, you know? So I start to see like, oh, things are changing from a moment to the next. Not the thing itself, you know? It's not that the thing also will pass. The tree at some point will cut or die, but it's also from my immediate experience. So it's a kind of change that is even more unstable and quick. Am I relaying this in some? Because this is revealing the shaky nature of experience, like a kind of passage or instability or impermanence that is, it's from the point of view of experience. That's how we experience the world. So I'm, one moment, I'm the worst meditator. The next, because of the unstable and changing nature of perception, the next moment, I'm the best meditator. And so not much maybe might have changed there, like some mostly the same cells, mostly the same. But the experience, boom, has changed in 1 second, you know? It's amazing. I was telling this in one of the group, and I talked with this about Heather on the first or second, at the beginning of the retreat, one evening, Heather did something like a very small gesture of the hands. And I've known Heather for 8 years or more. I have a friendship I really enjoy. When I think of Heather, it's happy, it's joyful, makes me smile. When I see Heather, I smile. She made the gesture, which at the end of the little story it will be revealed that it meant nothing. But for me, when there was this gesture, it suddenly felt like there was meaning to it. There was something about taking something or making some kind of rules or something. Like it was interpreted like this. And suddenly, the way I thought about Heather was, what is this woman saying to me with this gesture? Like the tone was very different. There was really like a, and suddenly Heather the friend was gone. Heather was still doing her Heather thing, you know, being Heather. But my experience was impermanent. It was not so much Heather that was changing, but my inner, from the point of view of the experiencer, suddenly there was a kind of an enemy there. To use the word, you know, what is this woman, you know? And suddenly there was like, need to defend myself, you know, like, I don't know, like, it was a completely different field. Light had not changed, you know, like, there was not many changes external, but inwardly, it was a different universe. And we, with our attention, we start to see this, like, wow, this world is unstable from the inside, maybe from the outside also, but from the inside it's amazingly unstable. It's changing, you know? And anyway, so I was somewhat able to recognize that there was a trigger, you know? And so I said to Heather, you know, when you did that gesture, what did it mean? And I was like, well, this is what I was doing. And I was like, are you sure? Because what your intention in this mind was, you know, and everyone was like, she was so cool about it. She was like, no. And then I could see like, oh, yeah, I've seen that pattern. You know, like that's not the first time, you know. The common denominator is not Heather. It's the spine. and so I was able to see this, and we worked it through pretty well, you know. But it showed the unstable nature of mind and experience. And so for me in this practice, this has revealed a lot how things are changing in this way. Also, the more I'm awake, available, sensitive, the more things are highlighted, it's really what happens to me as I sit here. I'll notice, wow, you know, the experience of when we were outside, some of us waiting for this talk, is gone. It's completely gone. Like the ephemeral nature of experience, how even before, even when I was opening this computer a few seconds ago, is gone. It's gone. And I have no idea what's coming. My mind tends to organize the future, you know, it's probably going to last a few more minutes of this, you know, before we start moving, you know. But I actually, the more attentive I am, the more I actually notice that I have no assurance of the next moment. It's unknown. It hasn't taken life yet. I can make all kinds of assumptions, and maybe it's good that I make a few, you know, but still. And sometimes when yogis encounter this real uncertainty, unknowing, unexistence of the future, they have something in the description of the development of insight that is called terror, you know, because suddenly there's a, like, wow. Actually, I've been living on assumptions, ideas about what will happen. I actually have no idea. So there can be a little terrifying passage there. But it's just another bad news, on, you know, kind of a bad passage or something, because it also reveals the kind of preciousness of this. This is amazing that we're sitting like this now, that there's this encounter. Because soon enough, it's not going to exist anymore. It's going to be gone, you know? And so, I remember one time doing the walking meditation outside during a retreat, and I was really attentive, the foot rising and pushing. And just at the moment of placing, suddenly I had this insight. I really saw clearly that I was assuming that there would be ground, you know? Like I was, and that there would be a next moment, you know, and it just appeared like a flash, like, wow, that's an assumption. I take it to be reality, but it was just revealed in a flash that I actually had no idea what was coming, that it was a guess, you know, a safe guess, you would think, you know, but still, that there was something mind-constructed about it, that there was not this stability and duration, really, you know, that it was projected. And I remember, like, I had real fear. And then, oh, yeah, now this is how it is. You know, there is ground. So that's one of the characteristics that we become more aware of. You know, it's not so much the taste as the soup, but the taste is gone. The crunchy is now soft. Experience of crunchiness is gone. Things are gone like this. Wow. And you might think, why? Why would you get so excited about crunchy being smooth, you know? This is the freeing nature of this is to realize that things go, they go. So the day that we might find ourselves in the doctor office and we'll say, like, oh, actually that result, you know, that health bit is gone, you know, or we might, I know about things being gone suddenly. You know, I've had a lot of this experience because it happens all the time. If I'm attuned to it, I am experiencing death all the time. And it's quite fine, you know? But things are gone. Thoughts are gone. Pleasant experience, especially pleasant experience, at some point they go. They're gone. You know, and to realize, oh, it was really enjoyable. There was really a aliveness of enjoyment. And now, it's not there anymore. Or there was anxiety or confusion, and now there's just soft touch of cool air. You know, it's, that experience is gone, absent now. In this way, maybe I can make the kind of link to the other characteristic that is another, it's kind of the same thing a bit, but a different angle, that because things go all the time, they cannot satisfy deeply or sustainably. It's not in their nature. They appear, they're there for a moment, and they go. Mind states go, the most beautiful mind states go, the beautiful thoughts go, things go like this. This we can think of, but to have a direct experience of this and seeing, wow, things are ephemeral, dreamlike. That's an adjective that the Buddha used, apparently. Dreamlike nature, like fleeting, is that the word? What I like about this, it looks again like a bad news, but to me it's really linked to freedom, liberation, because I'm liberated from expectations from things, expecting that this will satisfy. No, it won't. It can't. In a very deep, sustainable, solving everything kind of way, it can't. I think there's something poignant in that. That as sweetness, in maybe in the bitterness, it's bittersweet, you know. But it's the kind of joy of the truth. It's like, if you, when we touch this, it's like, oh, wow, things are disappearing, fleeting. They're there just for a moment. There's no deep satisfaction possible in that. Wow. Amazing. I don't know how, but it feels to me like, oh, now I can really feel them. I can really be with them. There's not going to be the overlay like, I was expecting you to satisfy me, and you better satisfy me, and, you know, and all this stress, is it going to satisfy me? Is it going to do it? Is that thing going to do it? The health back, the partner, the children finally saying this thing that they haven't said for a number of years, you know, or doing this. Is that going to be satisfying? No, it's not. And please, again, ehipasiko, see for yourself. Do not believe the being on the stage. You know? We have to check this for ourselves. It's so freeing for me, that aspect. I love that aspect. We call it dukkha, the unsatisfactory nature of the universe. And sometimes we feel it when things also are... even when they go well, there might be a little stress that we hope it's going to stay like this. You know, we fear we might lose that. So we can become aware of that, you know, and say like, actually, I am going to lose that. Can that be okay? Can that be okay? And that is a practice in and of itself, you know, for sure. Therefore, I'm presenting it almost as a logical thing, but this is to be experienced for ourselves. But one of the understanding that might come as we're attentive like this and we see the fleeting nature and we see the unstable nature of any arising, we see that we can't own anything. We can, on a certain, what we call conventional degree reality, we can say, yeah, this is my cushion. This is your cushion. But ultimately or absolutely own anything? Not possible. This to me also is something that is so relieving. Oh, I can't truly own a person, a thing. I can't totally own or identify, own in this way, saying, this is me. Because that great memory that I'm so proud of is conditional. It might not stay. This health is not really mine. There is health, maybe, but it's not really mine because, and it's important to take care of it. But to me, there's some a recognition of the truth when I say, oh, nothing can truly be owned. My idea. There's an owning, maybe, but watch out, it might change your idea. You know, it's passing through. You know? And when there's an owning, apparently, there's a stress that comes with that. I had an experience of this yesterday. That's why I joked yesterday when Heather was saying something about the rainbow, you remember? I said, I was the first one to to see it. Actually, it was not my experience. I was not the first one to notice it. But something, that's why I made the joke, is because something happened. Is I was looking at the rainbow, like a number of us, and the beauty and the eagle was flying in the rainbow. And at some point, I noticed that people at the windows up there were watching us. They couldn't see the window, but they were watching us, seeing that we were watching something. And when I saw that I was watched, suddenly I existed. You know, I was like, I... And suddenly I was watching the rainbow even more, you know, because I... It was such... And that was highlighted. It was like, oh, I was born. I was born in that moment. Before there was no I, there was just joy of the rainbow, some, maybe something like this. Suddenly when I was seen watching the rainbow, and I was like, oh, that is stressful. Suddenly, like, I exist. You know, I define myself. I am the rainbow watcher, and you are not. And again, I was like, wow, this owning of stuff is painful. It's a trouble. It's a level of complexity that we could really do without. But here's the formation right now. That's how it forms in the mind. That's how the mind is perceiving stuff. And that's how it arose, you know. There was not I the whole time. I arose. And I see this sometimes, everything's going along fine until somebody says something that I don't want to hear, or that I don't agree, or that is mine, you know. It's like I don't own the plate, really, until somebody takes it. You know, suddenly it's my plate, you know. What are they doing with my plate, you know? So anyway, seeing the arising of the I like this, and that again is something, I mean, this is so counterintuitive, you know, that is the kind of the secret in the Buddhist practice, the kind of hidden gem, maybe we could say. But that's something we want to clarify, and I think that is something we are all clarifying as we sit here. And the way I see this is, I'm going to use a series of images that the Buddha uses that you might recognize in your own experience. The Buddha seemed to have said that the body was like foam, like the foam at the side of the ocean or the river, you know, pointing to the fact that it's always changing form. You say, no, you know, I've been having the same height and weight for the last 2 years. It's not what I'm talking about. I'm always talking from the point of view of the experiencer or the experience. That I'm sitting like this, and now the experience of the body is like pushing like this here, like that there, it's like this here. This is the experience. And after the talk, I'm going to stand up, and it's going to be like foam. It's completely going to change experience. Even while I'm sitting, it's tingling like the foam as bubbles that are, you know, bursting. And the Buddha was pointing to, look at not your idea of the body, but the experience of it is something that is expanding, contracting, you know, pressing, heating up, too hot, get cold. It's like foam. So it's pointing to the impermanent nature of the experience of the body changing all the time, and pointing to the fact that, can you really own that deeply? Can you own tingling? Can you own heat radiation or the touch of cold? it's something that is known but cannot really be owned. It's passing. When you'll be in the hot cabin over there, you know, is where is going to be the coldness on the surface of the skin? That was a passing experience. So with the attention, we become more and more aware of this constantly changing the body. Then he compared the experience of perception, the way we understand what's happening, the way we organize the world, as he used the image of a mirage. That, again, pointing to the impermanent nature of it. When I was referring to, I'm the best meditator, I'm the worst, I want to sit a long retreat, get me out of here, you know? This is for me, this is so not for me. I love these people, they're so annoying. You know? All these perceptions changing all the time. He says, watch, be careful, become aware of your perceptions, how they change all the time, you know? I'm so happy I had 10 years with that person, you know? Like, why was I with that person, you know? I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating some, maybe not, you know? And to see how perceptions are changing all the time and unreliable, uncertain, you know? The pleasantness and unpleasantness we feel, the Buddha compared to bubbles. And as we sit and become aware of this, we see that there are bubbles. You know, there's the, oh, it's so beautiful, yeah, but, you know, and whoops, it's gone, the bubble is gone. Or, so quiet in here, and then ruffle, gone. You know, the pleasantness of the quiet is gone because there's, I have an opinion about ruffle. Is that the right word? And so, that, how can you own that? How can that be owned? We can really agree that it's there. It's being experienced, the body. But it's not really mine, it's changing, and I have to take care of it. The perceptions, you know, when I'm looking around now, when I look around now, I can't help, and it's a good thing, but it organizes the world, cushion, men, women, elderly, young, you know, like all kinds of things come up to my mind. They're not exactly thoughts, they're organization of the world, you know. This is sound, this is not touch. You know, it lands, and the more I become aware of it, it's not so much the kind of perception, it's the fact that it's impersonal. It does that. I cannot look at purple and not kind of know that it's purple and not green. There's always this river of organizing the world. Good thing, you know, but not personal. Oh, that too I can't own. Amazing. Shall I go on with the other images? Two more. The Buddha compared this one, I like you, I think you're gonna like too. He compared the kind of, I'll talk about it in terms of thought process. So I'm sitting here, quiet, and I start thinking, I need a car, you know, something like this, let's say. I haven't had a car in 10 years, but now I'm at that point in my life where I need a car, you know. Then, 5 minutes later, oh, yeah, wanting to be here. This kind of movement, the Buddha said, this is a little bit like a banana tree trunk. Banana is a tree that bears fruit, it's impressive, beautiful, it's a very special kind of green leaves, fruits. When it bears its fruit, after it falls flat on the ground, there's no core to it, it's empty at the center, you know. And he says, we live in banana productions, you know. We're kind of like, there's always a generator, you know, there's a sound heard, you know, plane. Why do planes pass here? They should limit the field so planes don't come over here. Like, let that one go, Pascal. You know? That was a banana tree bearing its fruit and falling flat, you know. And these things have a life on their own also, yeah. And we identify with this, we think. But in the process, we're clarifying a lot of this. Oh, there is pleasantness. Oh, there was thinking. There was a fascination for thoughts. It's gone. You know? We could put in the banana district or production, we could put the emotions. you know, with the thought come a feeling of like, oh, you know, some kind of something, you know, and it does its thing, it has its life, and it disappears. And it's another kind of thing that does its thing and then become composed for something else. You know? And we clarify this is very liberating, that we say, oh, there is fear. I'm not a fearful person, or there is guilt, or there is ease, there is calm. Not like, oh, I'm so calm. As soon as there's the identification and the owning, it becomes a little complex. And we clarify this as we sit, oh, there is calm, it's wholesome. It's not so much that it's mine or not mine, it's more that it's helpful or unhelpful. That's the kind of switch that we make. Generosity anywhere is helpful. It's not so much, I'm generous. Do you see that I'm generous? It's, there's generosity here, that's good. It feels good. The last one, the last area of identification that we start, maybe, I'm going to suggest it at least, questioning the identification we have with that is consciousness. Maybe we'll say, okay, Pascal, I agree, I'm not the body. There are these sensations, there are these, need to attend to them, you know, not mine. I agree, emotions, not mine, they're there, but not exactly mine. They pass by when the conditions are right. Thoughts also, but I am the knower. I am the observer. Well, the Buddha went as far as questioning even that. He said, be attentive to the knowing quality, not just the sensations, but the knowing quality of experience. It's something that is knowing that. And the closer you get to this, maybe, you'll see that the closer you get to this, the less personal it will seem. It's just, there's this thing called knowing that is active. There's a knowing, there's encountering the world. This is not also mine. Superficial awareness that we have most of the time will go from thinking, this is me, this is, or this is mine, or I'm inside this, or it's inside me. Four versions, very easy. The Buddhists seem to have said again that we were going from one to the other, unquestioning this, you know. Emotions inside of me. I'm inside the body. This is my joy. You know, do you see this a little bit? So we can take anything, and there's going to be a kind of a owning. If there is identification or owning or fusion, we could call it, it's going to be either this is me, this is mine, I'm inside of it, or it's inside of me. As I sit, it becomes more clear that it's actually happening, it's truly happening. There is thinking. But it's not so much clear that I am thinking or there's thoughts inside of me. Or, oh, there's just thinking and it's known. Wow, that's a big, rich field. But that's the kind of arc that I see. The specific nature of what the ideas about the world, the encounter with the world, and suddenly the passing of the events or phenomena of experience, and the fact that they can't actually completely provide satisfaction because of their passing nature, and that they, oh my God, can't be owned because they appear when conditions are right and disappear. They really do exist. It's not like nothing exists. They do exist, but it's amazing. So, for example, now I'm about to ring the bell. I bet ya that will arise in you the sudden intention to rise up. It will seem very personal. I have the intention to rise. It's me deciding to rise up. Very funny that it happens for most people at the same time with the bell. You know, it's conditional. These things appear when the conditions are right. You know, when we do yoga, a dozen people doing yoga here today or yesterday, And suddenly everybody at the same time has the intention to lift the arm. How strange is that? It seems very personal. What are you saying? I'm lifting the arm. Well, it's interesting that there was somebody just mentioned a few seconds before, lift the right arm, you know? And then suddenly I have, oh, it's conditional. That's how it appears. The intention to lift. And if you say, yeah, but I was there. I didn't lift my arm. What made that so? What made that so was that there was tiredness, or there was ache in the arm, or there was fear of hurting the arm, you know? This is what made the decision not to lift. And we, do you agree that on superficial look, or I'm talking French here, but translating my word not so well, but and with superficial awareness, it really seems that it's me. But on the closer I get to, I see that things arise out of conditions. If you come here tonight for the last sit or not, it will seem that you decide. I don't know, maybe tiredness will, maybe discouragement will, maybe reactivity will, maybe wisdom will decide to go to bed or not, you know. Something is going to be driving the show that we call I when we have superficial attention. The closer we get in this practice, the closer it becomes clear that it's something else that decides. And it's possible to encourage wisdom to make the decision. You know, that's what we're doing here. We're feeding wisdom, we're feeding clarity, we're feeding the wholesome state so they get to decide instead of the reactivity, the habitual ways. You know? So, I think it's going to be like this for tonight. So let's just take a moment here to maybe experience the foam-like nature of this body, or the last image that I might not have named is the magic show of consciousness appearing as mine, as me, this knowing quality, the great magic show. I am deciding, I am knowing. Is that so? May our wise attention bring amazing depth of clarity in order for true release of the heart to happen, maybe in order to offer also release and freedom to others. Okay, thank you, and please enjoy the magic of the evening.